email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the summer months can be difficult for children with additional needs and their parents without the routine and structure of school. But with the right tools and strategies in place, you can support your child, and this can also empower you as a parent. Our next guests, using their professional expertise and their own experience of living with a physical disability and parenting a child who is autistic, have put together a website, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, we welcome Kevin Pryor, a senior paediatric occupational therapist, and Áine Curtin, who's a paediatric occupational therapy assistant. Hello, Kevin.
Hello,
Áine.
Hello, how are you?
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We've an awful lot to cover.
Mm-hmm. We do.
So just in case we will get to this, but just everydayotireland.com.
Yes,
everydayotireland.com. And yeah, the OT in the middle is occupational therapy.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, can I start with, because your story is ongoing, recently, what happened?
Well, recently I electively decided to get my leg amputated, which by its very nature is something that is kind of a strange sentence to say.
Yeah.
What
age are you?
I'm 38.
Okay.
Although I have a very strict moisturizing regime that makes me look younger. but I have been making this decision, if I'm honest, I made it early in my 30s.
Right.
I was born with a congenital leg deformity. So it required me to get several operations. The one most kind of important was when I was later on kind of going into puberty, which I had to get a limb lengthening operation to lengthen my left leg because it wasn't growing at the same rate as my right. I was also born with four toes on my left foot, and I also had an ankle deformity. So there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was kind of a pioneering enough surgery to have. And as far as I know, I think there was only another guy in France that had, I think his name is also Kevin, ironically. But my parents strived to kind of give me the best that they could and made the decision to get the operations to see how we can go and how well it would kind of, the outcomes would be.
Right.
The operation itself from when I was around 13 didn't have the outcomes that we wanted. So although it had the leg length the same, it had a lot of other complications in my ankle and my knee, which then...
Just, can you go back? So how do they lengthen
so a leg? It's actually a procedure called an Lizarot frame. Right. And it's like a metal cage that would go around your leg. They put pins through your leg, the bones in your leg, or arms or wherever it would be. It's actually designed during the war. They were doing this to restructure bones. And they break the bone and gradually spread it, so new bone grows between it.
Uh-huh.
Over a number of weeks and months.
So it's like a natural bone graft.
Like a natural bone graft,
yeah,
and it would just spread it slowly. Now it sounds that it was easy. It was very painful.
Yeah, I know.
Lots of infections in the pin sites,
and there must have been chats with you and your parents that it wasn't guaranteed a successful outcome at the time.
Yeah, they all that was kind of covered, but the fact that I suppose it was designed to give me better outcomes than what I was having, in particular as I was hitting puberty and growing. They knew that the leg discrepancy was only going to get worse. So the outcome, although the leg length was the same, the ankle stability and the foot in itself didn't really have the best outcome.
And never did.
And never did from there afterwards. Right. So I was put into... I had a lot of rehab around that, and then I had what's called an AFO, a splint. I was splinted to kind of fuse my ankle without actually getting it fused into a position. And I wore a splint for years, and I endured a lot of pressure points, skin breakdown, knee pain.
Okay.
But I'm very, and Áine will agree with this, I'm an incredibly stubborn person.
Mm-hmm.
And I strive to kind of do the things that the rest of my peers were doing.
Yeah, fair enough.
Wanted to play GAA, wanted to play football. But as the gap started to grow around 15, 16, I wasn't able to do it. So I naturally gravitated towards more.
Was that heartbreaking for you?
That was hard, but like, as Áine talked about this, and my wife Sinead as well, and my parents, do I regret the decision to get it amputated? Not at all, because my leg didn't owe me anything, but I owed it a lot because it made me who I am.
Okay. Yeah, of course. You're a fighter.
I've kind of fought through all of that. So I kind of tended then to gravitate towards basketball and hurling and stuff that I could do with my hands. And that really worked well for me for many years. Right. You know, So
that wasn't successful at 13. You were living with some sort of workaround.
Mm.
And at what stage then did you decide that the best thing for you was to get your leg amputated?
So that didn't come into my head, honestly, until I had my first daughter. So my daughter's going to be 10 soon enough, actually, in November. I have too many children.
Only it's going to be 11.
Oh, sorry, 11.
just people are probably curious about the relationship. Yes. So Sinead's your wife.
Sinead's my wife.
And Anya's sister.
And Anya is my sister.
So we are not
Sinead
married.
Sinead is this, right.
We are definitely, and there's a big thing about how we're not married.
No. Right.
I actually have known Anya nearly as long as she is alive.
So I was 12, I think. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So he's like my brother. That's it.
So my wife and I met very early. In fact, she's the one that endured a lot of this with me.
So when you had your first daughter 10 years ago, that's when you start thinking.
I started thinking that I wanted to run around with my grandchildren. And I want to have the ability to have the same level of playfulness and enjoyment that my parents have with my kids. And Anya's parents have my kids, and have that freedom to do that. But my leg was only getting worse, and it was starting to affect my hip, my knee, and my good side. And it was probably that my eldest daughter was not much of a sleeper, so I was getting up at 4 a.m. and I was starting to feel a bit more of the pain that I was enduring, and I was becoming more aware of it. So this only came into conversation pre-COVID.
So it's sort of counterintuitive that to be more mobile, you had to get your leg amputated.
Yeah. And that wasn't an easy decision to make. And I suppose professionally, I knew this from my own profession.
Because you're an occupational therapist.
Occupational therapist. And we study a lot of this, and we work with amputees, and we work with ergonomics, and we work about function. Our job is about function and everyday tasks and what's meaningful for a person. And I was starting to lose things that I found meaningful. So I wanted to have control of it.
And you knew from working with people with prosthetics that you could do these things that you couldn't do if you had a prosthetic leg.
And if I had it, and I ignored it for many years.
Right.
Now, I wouldn't have dealt a lot with prosthesis. We had placements and we learnt about it, but I ignored it.
It's a big decision, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. And actually,
because
pre-COVID.
And this is what you said, you're unusual in that it was elective. Because most people, and my dad was included when he was alive, he had an amputation, but it was an emergency amputation. It was. I remember the doctor saying life or limb.
Yeah.
You know, that was the expression he used. But for you, in the fullness of health, to go and say, listen, will you chop my leg off?
And it was a difficult decision. Like, I am fortunate enough that I had full function. I had no pain. I had nothing.
Right.
And I was actually swimming. I swim in the National Aquatic Centre a lot. And I often would see the Paralympians training. And then my friends would say that I got my leg cut off to fit in now at this stage.
Yeah, sick friends.
But. But I would have seen the level of function that they had. And I was gritting my teeth, doing the things that are everyday tasks that I shouldn't.
Yeah.
So I had a consultation with the same surgeon that done a lot of my job, the previous histories and surgeries. Spoke to my parents, spoke to my wife around the decision that I would have made years ago that I was thinking this, and I put it out in the open. They all thought that it was a bit harsh and dramatic, and it was a bit of a kind of a buy-in from this. They were very full supportive around it, but it was obviously a bit of a shock, particularly for my parents, because they put a lot of time and investment into trying to
get it right
me
for you,
where I was. And I think that, understandably, as a parent now, I can see that. I can see how harrowing that could be for them to see that at the other end of it.
So when did it happen? When was the operation?
So nearly 3 weeks.
Three weeks?
Not even. Yeah, 3 weeks on Thursday post-op. Made the decision to do it. Don't regret it. However, I will say at this current moment in time, I knew about phantom pain. So phantom pain is something that constantly is described from amputees in regards to experiencing. But I thought it was pain that you experienced post your operation or before your operation. So it was historic pain that you would still continue to feel.
All right.
And I had no pain coming into it.
Right.
And now I'm on the other side of it and I'm experiencing significant phantom nerve pain.
Because, I've never experienced it, obviously, but does this pain then exist in where your foot would be if you had
where it. My foot is, yeah. Right. So
it's floating.
It's floating. It's there. That's so we crazy, talk about it, and even in a lot of the stuff that we talk about in OT and the stuff that we talk about every day, we talk about something that's called proprioception. And proprioception is your ability for your brain to interpret where your body is in space. Uh-huh. So I can send messages from my brain down to my toes, my left toes. I can ask it to move, but the message that I'm getting, there's no message coming back. So my body is trying to figure out that neural pathway now, right. And it must be sending a lot of stuff back that's kind of saying there's something wrong here. So it's
that's
sending
phantom pain.
Well, in that's how I'm describing it and how I feel of it.
I did say, and we're going to come back to you. I did say we have a lot to cover. Mm-hmm. And the reason you became an occupational therapist was you encountered a very good occupational therapist when you were younger. And they asked you what you wanted to do, yeah. as opposed to telling you what you couldn't do.
Yeah.
Now, Áine, your daughter is autistic.
She is, yeah.
Yes. And that's where you came to occupational therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure most people know that there isn't a lot of services out there at the moment. And I've known my daughter, she was autistic since, I'd say, 18 months old. And I was left to figure it out on my own. I couldn't get access to anything. I couldn't get an assessment of need. I couldn't get a diagnosis. But I knew professionally, so did Kevin. So I figured it out on my own. I loved all the information. It was so helpful for me at home. And me and Kev kind of just figured maybe we could put the two of us together and create what we've created. Never thought it would end up like this, but
it's a path that kind of naturally intertwined.
Yeah.
So
will somebody tell me then occupation therapy and autism? What's the...
So basically supporting a child with all of their activities of daily living, whether that's from getting dressed, eating, going to school. It really covers a number of areas in a child's life. And for me, it's been absolutely life changing having that support from me, because I'm not getting it from anywhere else. I obviously get it from Kevin, but I always say that I was the most unemployable person in the world. So if I didn't work for myself, I don't know where I'd be, because sometimes my daughter won't go into school, or she's having a really hard day or really hard week or month. And I just wouldn't be able to work. Yeah. I wouldn't be able to, nobody would be able to rely on me. So then another reason for us saying, like, I think we need to start our own thing. So it's been very, very successful that I can just work whenever I can and whenever it suits.
It's a spectrum. So
we're
just talking about your daughter here.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously routine is important.
Absolutely.
So in the introduction, we were talking about the summer months being a particular challenge for people with children who have additional needs, like your daughter.
Yeah.
Because they're thrown out of the routine.
Yeah. And it can be very difficult as well on the parents, because some people really look forward to the summer, the break from school. I myself look very much forward to the summer, but there's a lot of parents that don't. It's extremely difficult. It's not like our children can go to summer camps. We're not very lucky a lot of the times to get July provision.
What is July provision?
So it's like support that you can get a couple of hours, maybe 40 hours for a child with additional needs can get access to. It's kind of like a summer camp, or they do activities with an SNA or a qualified teacher.
And it's specifically in July.
Yes.
That's what it's called.
But
July.
We didn't get access to this year.
Why not?
So her school didn't run it. And you can go find someone yourself, a teacher, an SNA, but my daughter's not going to go off with a random person I just found on the internet to go spend 40 hours a week. So they can do different activities. They can bring them to the shopping centre. They can play with them at home. But by the time my daughter was comfortable with that person, the time would be over.
Can I talk to you a little bit, Áine, about assessment of needs and diagnosis?
We've had quite a journey
people,
with that.
So for people who aren't in this world,
mm-hmm.
The Disability Act of 2005
says
you apply for an assessment of needs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have to be assessed within 3 months of
and we waited, we're close to 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah, and I'm not the only one. There's thousands and thousands of parents.
So there's a law in place.
There is.
The Disability Act 2005 says that once you apply,
mm-hmm.
you have to get an assessment of needs within 3 months, and it took 5 years.
I can guarantee there's probably not one child in Ireland that has ever got it within 3 months. No. So I threatened legal action to get an assessment for my daughter. So they outsource us to a private multidisciplinary team, shall we say, and it just didn't work out the way I thought it was going to be.
So to get an once you get an assessment of needs,
you get,
when eventually you get it,
mm-hmm.
is that the same as the diagnosis?
Or you get a diagnosis if there is one there at the end of it. Yeah.
Right, okay.
And we got nothing with the HSE. Okay. We got no assessment at the end of it, so I had to pay €2,000 to go get a private psychology assessment.
That's a private diagnosis.
I suppose the challenge here was that my goddaughter, Anonia, we had the chat earlier on that my goddaughter was showing characteristic signs of autism.
So yeah, this is Anya's daughter. We're not going to name her. Yeah.
I was having the split that side from brother-in-law, friend to professional and clinician, and have a chat to say, listen, I would have concerns that there are diagnostic criteria or diagnostic features here that would require further assessment. Mm-hmm. So we supported to go through, like every other parent in the country will do, to go through the assessment need and do that.
Obviously, through the HSE.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a conflict of interest, so I wouldn't do that, the assessment stuff.
So we didn't establish yet. But Kevin, you work in the HSE.
I work for both. So I work HSE and I work privately as well.
Okay.
Right. So Anya was very fortunate that we knew where we were going and what needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
She was provided with an assessment in time.
Yeah.
But that assessment didn't have the same outcome that we would envision because
she got every other diagnosis, potential diagnosis, but autism. So ADHD, DCD, ODD, everything but autism. And she was then and still is 100% autistic. But they.
How did you know that?
Because I know a lot about autism and it is clear as day that my daughter is autistic. She plays like an autistic person. Mm. She socializes like an autistic person. But I feel maybe the clinicians didn't have a lot of experience with how females present as autistic.
At the time, it was quite a strain on the family dynamics as well, because this is something that I would have brought up and that it. We were in the know, and at least I think I'm in the know of it. And we had three clinicians that said anything but and gave other diagnoses flippantly rather than actually doing a comprehensive assessment of what was needed to be done.
Yeah.
And the challenge here was then that.
Okay, so you had to pay for an assessment.
I had
needs,
to go privately.
€2,000.
Yeah.
Well, and is that common with people?
Yes.
Well, people have to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a lot of money.
And can I just ask you then? So waiting 5 years then, that's sort of 4 years and 9 months beyond the 3 months.
Yeah.
That's crucial time.
So she started Montessori with no diagnosis.
Yes.
She started school with no diagnosis. She has a very negative association of school now because she was thrown in somewhere which didn't suit her needs.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything on paper to prove to people.
So as an occupational therapist, you're not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but as an occupational therapist, early intervention obviously is hugely important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So actually what happened around that time frame was Anya was, well, rightly so, was finding it quite hard.
No, I really suffered in my mental health. I really did. It was a lot to carry. I'm on my own. So it was a lot to try figure out on my own. Nobody listened to me anywhere I went. Only my family. Thank God I had support there. But I had teachers telling me this, that and the other, like, and I was trying to say, no, she is autistic. And they're like, well, you have no diagnosis. So she's not getting these accommodations. She's not going to get these supports until it's on a piece of paper.
I suppose I only just wanted to know, like every other family, just wanted to know what to do and how best to support the child. So
it is odd. And I remember Brendan O'Connor writing about his daughter, that it's a very strange thing for a parent to want a diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, to want,
especially when you know it's there, but
you want it because when you get it, it allows you access to
now
these
I still
services.
Get no services with it, but I still have it on paper for when she needs accommodations in school or if we need to use a lanyard to pass cues and stuff like that. But
how is she coping with summer now?
She doesn't really like school, so she's very happy. It's a different kind of happy. She's very happy to be not in school, but she struggles a lot because her routine has completely turned upside down. So we try keep it. We have a visual schedule that we follow. We recently
It's a chart on the wall.
It's a visual. So there's a picture, image, and text which shows her how her day is going to look. So we break it down: the morning, the evening, the afternoon, so she can know. And she's 10 now, so she knows kind of how the thing is going. And we recently just got a service animal. Her name is Cloda, and she has changed our life. It's been
what breed of dog?
She's a doodle,
right? And the brilliant thing then about the doodle, I remember hearing a documentary about this about 15 or 20 years ago when they were first introduced into Ireland.
Yeah,
is that it forms a triangulation. So if your daughter is out with Cloda, the dog, and somebody comes up, the people go to the dog first.
Yes,
Yeah. Is that part of it?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, you know, so she's not meant to be petted when we're out together. Right. And I always thought it was children that were going to come over and pet her, but it's actually adults that come over straight over. I'm like, oh no, she's working at the moment. But Claude has allowed us to go to the cinema and she's really happy. We can go walk around the shopping centre. She helps me bring her, put her to bed. Like, it's just been amazing.
And what effect has she had on your daughter?
I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, she, first of all, it's like her pal. So it's like her friend in the house. She talks to her. She rubs her while she's going to sleep. And Claude is trained in a multitude of things to support my daughter in her everyday life.
It's very strange since I got my amputation. Claude is also there.
Claude is like knows that Kevin's
where
hurt
my goddaughter
as well.
Is kind of regulating, settling, and having fun.
Okay. Claude is like, I'll go over to him and help him.
This is my second person now.
So everyday OT Ireland.
Yeah. So we actually hit yesterday. We hit 100,000 followers across our social media platform. So we're absolutely delighted. So
and it's focused on what in particular.
So it helps. We offer we offer support to parents. So we would ask our followers, "What are you struggling with?" And they would tell us, and then we'd make loads of content around that. Whether that's how to feed your child, how to get them asleep, how to regulate them, how to support them going transition to school. And then we also show our daily life. So what it's like for me being a parent, the struggles. I cry an awful lot on Instagram. And now obviously with Kevin's life and his family life.
Yeah, like it's always been unique in regards. It looks at the professional side of it. So the occupational therapy principles and theories and what we talk about and how we implement them in everyday life.
Yeah.
And Áine does that in everyday life.
I just never wanted parents to feel like I used to feel when I had nothing. So if we can give parents something, they can DM us and we will get back to them as most of them. It's hard now because we've loads of followers, but we just try to want people to know that we're there if they need support with something.
It's kind of funny because during the assessment need kind of debacle, Áine was very upset and I asked her to come to one of my presentations. And Áine doesn't really listen to me. And I said, please just come. And if you take something away, but you take something away from it, if you don't.
So
you
this
don't.
Is you in the HSE?
Is me just talking to a group of parents, similar. And I done a presentation on sensory processing and how that can impact everyday life. And Áine was in front row and centre. And I honestly thought that she wasn't going to take much from it.
I cried the whole way through.
She cried all the whole way through and I was like, are you okay? And it wasn't until it hit home that we were able to relate a lot of the challenges that my goddaughter was experiencing were actually at its fundamental piece was related to kind of sensory challenges.
Yeah.
Sensory challenges, right.
And from that, Áine took this and we both collaborated and showed then that actually when we talk and all the stuff that OTs, great OTs out there talk about with parents and try implement and empower them to do it, that it actually does work at home and empower them to do that.
Yeah, so this is overstimulation, is it?
Or it's dysregulation.
Dysregulation, so, right.
The environment for an autistic child, let's say in school, not all autistic children, but for some, your bright lights, loads of people chewing, talking, multitude of noises.
Paper even.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Paper. My daughter can't touch paper. She uses assistive technology in school. So after a day in school, my daughter collapses, basically. Right. She is so upset because she's not in the right school environment, but very upset, and that happens a lot of children because the environment in a lot of places is
so it means their brain is working overtime.
Yeah. They're taking in a lot more information and trying to process it at the same time, as well as trying to keep up with your peers and do your work and make sure you're doing everything correct. It's an awful lot for a child.
Awful lot.
Yeah.
So Kevin, it must be difficult for you because you're working in the HSE. How long does it take for somebody to get appointed with you in the HSE?
Currently, it's over 2 years.
Over 2 years?
Over 2 years, yeah.
Right.
And obviously, we don't put conflict of interest with that either. And we try to just, with our social media platform, to try and empower parents to give them tools and strategies that they can use at home.
But you must be conflicted then.
It is conflicted.
You have to listen to me all the time.
But you're tapping into this community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who are shouting out for more services.
Yeah.
And service provider.
It drives you more though, because you know where you're conflicted, so you try give as much as you can online.
And I try to, like that kind of free content online to help support. So if there is something that I met with in the clinic, that I'll come back and I'll say, Áine, I have this idea that we need to do and we need to show.
And why is the whole system so under-resourced?
Where should we start?
Yeah, that I don't know. I think it's a systemic issue, massively. Currently there's an embargo with an HSE.
Well, he was on over the weekend saying that embargo has been stopped.
Stopped. So, yeah. Well, whether or not it is stopped, it has to be seen on the ground. You know, there's just, yeah. There's not enough staff on the ground to help retain staff. And that's a challenge.
Can I ask you, why don't you just go leave the HSE and just do it privately?
If I'm honest, I'm actually a proud civil servant. Right. Like when COVID came, I was first to come up and say I want to answer and be redeployed. And that's in itself is conflicting in my head because
I'm sure you and a lot of your colleagues want to make the system better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're constantly hit with brick walls or funding and challenges. And that's hard for parents as well.
Everydayotireland.com. So back to where we started then. When have you been fitted for a prosthetic?
Hopefully, I get my staples removed tomorrow. I started a couple last week, but the wound wasn't ready yet. And then I get something that's called a stump shrinker. So I'm going out to Kappa Hospital. Wonderful team out there who I've already met.
And that shrinks your stump to...
Kind of molds it.
So the prosthetic will...
Into the socket and the socket will fit. And then hopefully fit for a prosthetic in September, which would be very exciting.
Yeah.
Now the challenge with this is, outside of all everyday OT and everything that we do, is that I only get one prosthetic for life. That's it.
But you can buy another one.
I can buy it.
How much is it?
15,000 to 22,000 euro.
Wow, expensive.
So if I had a medical card, I could get it, but I'm not by means necessary. I wouldn't get a medical card. But the challenge is that you'll get one for life and they last anywhere from 2 to 3 years, depending on how active you are. So it's like a second mortgage, you know.
Could you get it sponsored?
yeah. We're looking for collaborations. If anybody comes in, my leg is available for anything.
If you have 100,000 followers.
Yeah.
All you have to do is every time you do an Instagram post.
Yeah, yeah, throw the leg out.
Oh, we haven't been doing everything.
But it shouldn't even be that. Like, there's kids who are 18.
I'm completely joking. You know, completely joking here.
Oh, completely. And like, listen, I'm willing to sell my leg for anything. But
expensive, isn't it? 15
it's expensive. But kids who are 18 now who won't get any more prostheses. When they're growing, they're coming into the same thing. But that's all part and parcel.
Now, just one text there. The sad thing also is that at 18, when the autistic person leaves school, the supports are decreased or more than likely ceased.
Yeah.
Autistic children grow up to be adults and need socialising,
absolutely.
Employment, and ongoing psychological
support. That's a huge fear for
some. Loneliness is the greatest disability, says Paddy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, then there's dual diagnosis, isn't it? Because there's a big link between... being autistic and depression,
absolutely. Like my daughter's 10 and she has seen a clinician 3 times in primary care in her whole life, and she's 10. So there's nothing.
I'll just leave that hanging in the air.
I know.
Anya, thanks so much for coming
thank
in. I'm
so
sure
much.
We'll talk again. Kevin, you too. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Ray.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.